Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't it fucking. Ain't it fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Well, we get straight now?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Nice!
Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
My friend, it's the little victories.
The little victories.
It's the little victories that count in life, man. You can't always hit a home run, right? This podcast is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, I got nothing.
No, I'm just saying, man, that you have to have the little victories in life that will get you or tide you along till you get to a big victory.
You know, it's funny. You totally just caught me off guard here, but I'm thinking about in the course of the gazillion gigs we've done in our lives, you know, you might have a period where you're struggling and maybe a few gigs, things just aren't locked in and that, you know, it's not that effortless thing. And then that one gig comes along and it happens. And all of a sudden you're just like back in your little game. That little victory just kind of resets you and puts you in a place where you're not just, you know, hiding under the covers and wanting everything to go away. It's incredible how that is. But I consider those little victories that kind of.
It absolutely is. And who knows what brings those along, but before I get into my little spiel that I want to talk about is do you remember when I had that death plague of a flu that mm-hmm. lasted for 2.5 weeks that I was just completely on my back? The first gig and actually subsequent gigs after that, I felt like, man, I played better than I have in years.
Interesting.
And, I'm sure a lot of that is psychological from the standpoint that, man, I'm glad to be alive. Made it through.
True.
But, man, I feel like I'm playing as good as I've ever played right now. And I don't know, maybe the flu took it out of me. I don't know what it is.
I did it. I had a little hiatus way back in the day where I just...
Did you have to have surgery for that?
No. That was pretty good, though. I'm laughing on the inside. But anyway, I was in a not great place for a while, and I decided to go west and get my act together.
I love that story. That's a freaking tremendous story.
That's all there is to it. That's what's weird.
It
no,
makes...
I went out for almost a year, and I played 3 times. I came back and was burning.
Every time you mention something about that hiatus that you had when you go out there, what it does is it makes me long for the weather of Northern California.
So not my well-being.
That's ancillary, man. I just think of like 60 degrees with like light fog, and it's so appealing to me because we're getting ready to come into 90 degrees, 80% humidity.
Shh. Silence that demon mouth.
That makes your hiatus hurt, doesn't it?
That makes my hiatus crumble up and
go into a small fetal position.
Thanks don't mention that crap, man. That reminds me of like lawn care,
which is on the table right now, sir.
God help us.
I wanted to mention what I'm going to call the teacher's superfecta. That's my little victory that I've had over the last, let's say, couple of weeks.
I'm glad I distracted you this long.
That's all right, man. This little superfecta thing that happened, it all happened, like I said, over the period of like a week and a half, 2 weeks. And it's just a bunch of cool things that, you know, sometimes I think teachers and even musicians, if it's gig-wise type stuff, they gloss over and maybe don't give them quite their due. And then we've talked about before in the past how it's so easy to dwell on a negative thing and let it break you down when you don't realize that there's some little cool things that have happened. But I had four really super cool things happen. And the first one was one that really came out of the blue. An old student of mine that I taught when I was over at the University of Memphis, I had lost touch with him. Hadn't really talked to him in at least 10 to 15 years. But he keeps up with me through the show and just on social media as well. And out of nowhere, I go out to the mailbox and there's a CD in there. And he's still living in Memphis and playing with some of Memphis's best musical craftsmen. And he sent me this really cool disc that he just sounds like a million bucks on. And so it's just really nice, man. It's got a lot of that Memphis grit.
You know, I love it.
I want you to take that with you.
Okay.
And let you and check it out. There's some really cool stuff on there. So that's the first one. And then the second thing, man, I have a younger student who's about 14 years old that he's been studying with me for the better part of 2, maybe 3 years,
mm-hmm.
that I helped him prepare for an audition, and he just got accepted to the University of North Carolina School for the Arts, which is based in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and it is the, for lack of a better term, feeder high school that prepares kids to go to colleges, and in this case, most likely University of North Carolina, which is no slouch of a school. So,
kind of like a FAME kind of school.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And he got in. And so, wow, that's really cool. And then I had...
Can you tell me his family's going to move due to this?
They are, man. They live in the Atlanta area, and they put their house on the market last week.
Incredible.
Isn't that incredible, man?
I knew there was a kid after I had graduated that was living in Colorado, I want to say, and his parents up and moved just to get him in the high school program I grew up in.
It's incredible. The sacrifices that people will make.
I mean, like, I'll move on the couch so if my son wants to sit on one end, you know, because I'm thoughtful like that.
Well, it's the thought that counts.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm just trying to make sure you realize I'm an accommodating parent as well.
Man, you'd put the couch up for sale if you needed that little extra push of cash, right?
No. Nah.
Again,
my couch isn't worth anything, man.
It's the thought that counts. But yeah, he got into this school, and his percussion teacher is going to be John Beck Jr., the son of the other great percussionist, John Beck Sr., right? So that's quite a cool thing that this kid's got going for
Did
him.
Did Sr. teach at North Carolina as well?
No, man. I want to say that he was not maybe principal percussion or one of the percussionists for Philadelphia Symphony.
Oh, okay.
I think. Now, of course, that's going to be wrong, and we will be excoriated on social media, but we're accustomed to it.
Philly, that works. We know plenty of bad cats from Philly.
Yes, we do.
Ooh, that town.
Man. Yeah. And the third thing was I had an adult student who had been coming to me for the better part of 6-7 months, originally came to me for, of course, just regular drum lessons, but was in debilitating back pain. I mean, not just when playing drums, like living life back pain. And we worked on some things with this guy, man, and it has very blessedly transferred to his not only playing, but his regular life as well. So that's another little victory. Major victory for him, little victory for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth thing, to fill out the superfecta of horse betting teaching benefit, through this show and through the drummer tribute shows that have been happening, I have acquired quite a prodigious young man, and it is a mutually beneficial relationship that I genuinely look forward to these lessons, and I feel like he's really getting a lot out of it, and likewise, I'm getting a lot out of it. So it's just been a nice couple of weeks, man, from the standpoint of small victories.
I love it, man. We can be guilty of not recognizing those sometimes, you know, wallowing
totally
in our day-to-day or mm-hmm. whatever, and it's like, I think it's important as people, as creatives, as working musicians to celebrate those things. You know, and it doesn't have to be braggadocious. You could just celebrate it amongst you and your people in your head, you know, have a little party, you know, whatever.
Got plenty of those.
But it is something that I think is not only healthy, but it, you know, I mean, look, what we do, there's some sacrifice. What we do, there's some, it's just kind of tailor-made for beating ourselves silly and insecurity and all that stuff. So little victories can be a breath of fresh air. And you know, I think sometimes you have to work for those little victories or be willing to put in time to get them. But man, they can really be a lot of fuel for getting back on track or realizing you're, you know, doing what you want to do and what you love to do. So my thing is in encouraging people to take Phil's lead and realize, you know, smell the roses, I guess is a good way to put it.
Yeah, and man, boy, you said something that's worth $1 million in there, and that is sometimes you have to work for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's like a compounding effect, you know, where you might go a year and have almost or very few victories, and then all of a sudden you got this 2-week little period that the compounding effect of all this work goes into it, and all of a sudden you get one after the next, after the next, after the next.
Yep.
So, you know, you take it as they come. You put the work in and you take it as they come, and then hopefully it'll all pay off, man. And then, like you said, you make the most out of these little victories.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is sometimes those victories aren't even most beneficial to you, which is from a humanity perspective, is really cool too, man. I think there's a lot of healthy things in there that you're enjoying the success and progress of others and just being a part of it, because, you know, we don't lose sight of the fact that all your little victories as a teacher, there's another component, which is
the student,
and you're driving them to improve whatever they're concerns and that are, and man, that's all just bonus right there. You're benefiting others as well. It's cool.
Well, you know, as a teacher, and if you've been doing it for a while, and if you've had some success doing it, you do get these occasional things where you have a student that auditions and either gets into a specific school, gets into a specific band, makes an all-state, makes some sort of an honor group type thing, and you come to somewhat expect that type thing to happen if you do it long enough, right? But when you have something like this, when this disc comes in, that's a whole different kind of unexpected level of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's such an, because I mean, now you've also got a student that's doing things professionally for a living. You know, this guy's really, that's all he does is doing that. And then when you even take another aspect that, okay, I've helped this other adult student from the drumming perspective, but man, his quality of life has suddenly gotten better after dealing with back pain for years, is what he told me. And now suddenly, all of a sudden, this guy's got not only a little bit of drumming stuff happening, but he's got a quality of life aspect that he didn't have. Man, if that doesn't humble you a little bit, you know, from that standpoint, that's something else, man, having that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's just a really cool thing, man. And I don't take any of it for granted, because I think I've mentioned to you, John, several times, maybe not on the show, but, you know, I make my living playing drums. And the teaching thing, it's extra on top of it.
Supplemental.
It's supplemental. But the thing is,
but you're passionate about it.
I'm passionate about it, man. And let me tell you, I enjoy it every bit as much as doing a great gig.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I actually had a friend of mine who teaches as well, a mutual friend of ours, send me a video of some student of his, and I'm just like, I just love his passion for it as well, man, because I don't have that gene, for lack of better terms, but I recognize it in that I've had some amazing teachers.
Yeah.
And know the impact they had on me, and then to see some of my friends being in that position of influence is really gratifying. Pretty cool.
It leads into our topic today. It's not.
That concludes.
Yes.
The infomercial of the Phil Smith School of Drum. I couldn't do this. Hey, man, if you're looking for somebody to teach you that can cure your hemorrhoids, Phil's your guy.
Oh, I have a method.
God. Yeah. Let's move on to the topic.
Well, you know, John, you and I, this is another, the topic that we're talking about today is something that I mentioned to you months and months ago, and it took a while to kind of formulate how we wanted to approach it, because it's a little bit of a slippery topic and you have to put your mind to it to get it to a point to where you can actually talk to people about it and make some sense out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I approached you and I said, man, we need to do something that illustrates the importance of taking your time and trusting the process of that, taking your time and being patient. Because again, it will pay off in the long run by not taking shortcuts, by not being impatient, by not rushing yourself to get into certain different aspects of playing, networking, performing. Because a lot of times those shortcuts, maybe sometimes they work, but a lot of times, man, they end up being kind of a dead end where you have to go back anyway and then take the long run,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I thought what we would do is we would take some real pointed scenarios and say, look, this is one way I've seen this happen, but here's probably the better way to approach it. And so the first thing I want to talk about has to do a little bit with teaching and learning. And one of the common things that I see happening, and I think you see it too, just from the standpoint, even though you don't teach, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about, is first, when you're trying to learn something, and especially if it's going to be something that you're going to learn and use for a long time, it is absolutely 100% vital that you don't quickly rush and go through it and just skim the cream off the top.
Mm.
If you're going to be using something for a long time, and especially if you're going to be a professional musician, you need to learn it to gain the depth of the musical, we'll call it the musical bones.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to have that stuff down. And so what happens a lot of times, man, is when you have a student, or if you see somebody that tries to cram a whole bunch of stuff in to learn a bunch of stuff, one thing, you only kind of skim the top of it and you get really kind of a shell of what's going on. And then a lot of times that kind of leads into forcing that stuff into musical situations. And when you do that, man, it comes off as being shallow. You really don't have command of what you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, you know, the bare bones basic, maybe the notes might be there, but the real depth of what we're seeing played is different. And like, you know, take a perfect example of something, okay? We can listen to, say, let's say somebody like Billy Higgins, okay? There's nobody would ever tell you that Billy Higgins is this technical master that just has chops for days. He's the proverbial dig a trench guy, right?
Right.
Which that by the way, that little phrase, man, I've used that about 15 times since you said it the last time, and I'm going to use it a couple more times tonight also where it's applicable.
Burrows.
That's him? That's Burrows? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Burrow a trench. How about that?
It all right? Kind of comes together.
Okay, so anyway, you got Billy Higgins, man, and let's say he's digging a trench. Feels like $1 million, has that intangible feel, that intangible groove. You and I could take a student, teach him how to play that dig a trench style groove. We could teach him how to do it in 10 minutes, but it's not going to have that same intangible feel. Because he's just gotten the bare bones. He's just barely skimmed the top of it.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about Billy or Art Blakey or Chris, for that matter, that's beyond the getting the concept of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's living it for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of variables that come into play as to your success in digging a trench. I think the players trusting you that you're on the bandstand with, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. But it's kind of like a surgeon, you know, a new surgeon that's book smart and has the robotic thing figured out. Well, their instincts might not be so together that they foresee a problem that might need to be head off.
Yep.
You know, that kind of thing. So there is, that's great insight in that. I think some people are guilty of this. Yeah, I got it. You know, they're 23 years old. I got it.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, and technically you kind of are in the ballpark, but you know, very few guys that age are really going to have it. So going back to not rushing it.
See, and man, you are absolutely making this point also where you said, you know, at 23 years old, you know, well, yes, some guys have it. And I can, you know, hear people say right now, well, what about guys like Vinny and Tony? Because, you know, they're these legendary tales. And I'm sure you probably heard these before. Like, we'll take the one with like Tony Williams, for example. You know, Tony Williams from Boston stayed with Alan Dawson. And there's this legendary lore that he went and studied with Alan Dawson, had a handful of lessons from Alan, and then just magically everything just, it fell under his hands. He incorporated all this knowledge into his everyday playing. It didn't sound forced. It was just completely and totally integrated into everything he did. You know what? I'll give you that. But we're talking about Tony Williams.
Yeah, we need to get back to the subject of humans.
Humans, exactly.
Not freaks.
Yeah. And so you can see the same thing. You know, there's that story about Vinny Colaiuta when he and Steve Smith studied with Gary Chaffee in Boston at the same mm-hmm. time. And there's also that similar story that Chaffee gave him those early versions of those patterns books, and that Vinny went in. Chaffee explained all this stuff. Look, you need to work on this, need to work on this. And I think what the whole thing was Chaffee was saying, we're going to work on this the entire 4 years, you know, you're here at Berkeley. And then like a month later, Vinny's got it all down. Again, you're talking about Vinny Colaiuta.
Yeah. This is the downfall of man. Keeping up with the Joneses.
Yes.
And then the Joneses' ancestors from another galaxy. Uh-huh. None of that's going to work out well. But in drumming, in the drumming sense, the Vinnies and the Tonys are the Joneses to the 10th power, and you gotta get off of that trip, that lore, if you will, man, because we need to be realistic about what we're talking about here, which is the average person growing as a musician and growing with depth and knowledge and experience.
You know, some people will use comparison between different people as, we'll call it, a healthy form of competition or whatever, but you also have to be really careful that you don't fall into that category of comparison being the thief of joy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's exactly like you mentioned. If you're sitting there trying to compare yourself to Vinny Colaiuta working out of the patterns book, or trying to play the complex polyrhythmic style things or the linear concepts that he's doing, let me tell you, man, you're talking about Vinny Colaiuta.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the guy who wrote the stuff, so to speak.
I think as a teacher, and I think as elder statesmen, for lack of better terms, that many of us are, we need to be mindful of not glorifying that crap with kids, because A, very few are going to be able to develop that and, more importantly, use it, because it's just, where is the gig that you're going to be able to play like Vinny at his craziest and wackiest, or Tony at his deepest.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, rare is the individual who is ever going to comprehend and execute that. So you're setting up someone for failure on a lot of levels.
Fine line between encouragement and discouragement.
That's right.
Very fine line.
And when we're talking about levels of playing like that, that there's just, there's no reason to get, and not that you can't be excited about it and respect, and if someone's inquiring about it, encouraging, you know, but man, you can't stick this something in front of, you know, play a Vinnie Colaiuta track to a kid and be like, well, here's what your goal is.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, man.
Yeah. To the right student, it's going to be a great amount of encouragement. To the other student, though, that has an equal amount of potential to do great things, it can throw them in the ditch.
Yeah. They might not play anymore.
It's exactly right.
So there's a lot to be said about lore and legends and how we use them in our day-to-day lives, be it, you know,
yeah,
comparison or with students or just with our own expectations.
Another thing that I want to bring to everyone's attention is there's a tendency for certain students and professionals, other players, to want to work on and just master extremely elevated, complex concepts and technique before learning the basic or prerequisite material.
Mm.
Now, the shining example of that is, as a teacher, you'll have a student, which it's either a new student that contacts you out of the blue, or it could even be a student that you've had for a little while. And then they'll come to you very sheepishly, and they'll go, I want to audition for such and such school and such ensemble and such competition. And I need to start working on, you know, this. And they'll hand you over some solos, right? And it'll either be, say, like a snare drum solo, or could be a keyboard solo. Could even be a drum set solo for that much, right? A written out thing. And you look at it, and it's this incredibly detailed, very complex piece of music. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, we got our work cut out for us here, brother. And then I'll just look at him and I'll go, yeah, we can make this happen. When is your audition? 3 weeks from today.
Oops.
Okay. And I literally had this conversation with a student about, it's probably a couple months ago. And I said, this solo that you handed me, it was a concert snare drum solo. And by the way, this same student that came to me is also studying with John Lawless at Kennesaw State, working on timpani and keyboards, right? Mm-hmm. So he brought me this concert snare drum solo, and I just held it up to him, and after he told me 3 weeks, and I said, this solo right now, if you gave it to me or if you gave it to John Lawless and you told us that we had to play this to get into an orchestra or to get some kind of a gig in 3 weeks, I'd say we'd be pushing it.
You and John.
Yeah, John and I
at this point
would be pushing it.
Yeah.
To make this thing happen.
Yeah, that speaks a lot to the unrealistic.
To the unrealistic nature of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now here comes part two of Dig a Trench. So when you get to a situation like this where you have to, where somebody's wanting to do the impossible before it's time to do the impossible, you have to make some compromises to get to the point to where you can work your way up to making this Herculean task happen. What I did was I told this guy, I said, listen, there's really no way you're going to be able to sufficiently play this entire, because it was a long piece too, you're going to be able to play this entire thing. You need to contact this board that you're going to be auditioning for, and you need to tell them, be upfront with them and go, look, this is what's happening, and I can't make this happen in this period of time. Can I play a segment of it, like an excerpt? Ta-da, it worked, right?
Nice.
Yeah. So Dig a Trench, then, from that standpoint of make your expectations more attainable, and dig that smaller trench and play the crap out of that excerpt. Or, for example, from a drum set standpoint, somebody, let's say you've got to play some incredibly complex groove on something. You're digging a trench in that is get the bones of that groove,
mm-hmm,
and make it happen until you can then more effectively play it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of those things that I just am absolutely adamant about, is that you don't rush that process. You've got to have a little more foresight when it comes to these different auditions, or when you're going to be playing something that's that technically demanding that you don't have it under your hands, or at least a foundation,
mm-hmm,
under your hands. You got to make a compromise, but then at that same time, You'd have to start working on the foundational aspects of it to get to the point to where you can build upon it to where you can then play the full bare bone, the full extrapolated groove or the full solo. That's the only way I know how to do it, man.
And let's not lose sight about, in these scenarios, you're not going to get over on someone. You know, if you're playing a gig and
absolutely
some crowd sees you twiddling your sticks or you're doing some relatively simple, you know, linear fills and people are like, oh my God, it's amazing. Well, that's a whole lot different than, you know, the percussion chair at the university you're auditioning for and you're
or a panel of percussionists. Yeah,
BSing through
be.
This thing. Yeah. And so I was thinking like, man, if I had to do that, what my excerpt would be, I'd probably just play the last note and just be like, I know I'm not getting in.
Well,
see ya.
Let me tell you something, man.
I'd like to find a kid who had the balls to do that.
Well, some snarky guys, man, on that panel, man, they say if you played it with the proper conviction, they'd probably rather hear that.
Wouldn't doubt it.
You know
I
what I mean?
Yeah.
Than to BS your way through something and pretend, you know, like you know what you're doing.
Oh, man. That'd be funny as that scenario. Like, all four of them are like, we could get somewhere with this kid.
Yeah.
He's based in reality, you know.
I had a teacher one
I'm
time.
I'm going to go audition for some school now.
Can I be there to watch that?
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, I'm going to say you got at least a 10% chance of that going over really well.
I mean, that's 9% more than I thought.
So I had a teacher one time say something in regard to a long-term goal, and he used the terminology or the situation that, like, look, let's say that it's going to take you a year from the time you decided you wanted to play this solo or you wanted to play this one particular style of music, this advanced style of music, to get it under your hands to where you've really got it down. You've built up some musical depth and you really understand what you're playing and conceptually you're good and you can do all kinds of stuff with it and you can play it perfectly, right? Well, he said a lot of people are going to look at that and they're going to go, a year. Oh my God, look at all this other stuff I could do within a year. Well, he made the point. He goes, think about it like this. A year from today is going to come here whether you want it to be here or not in a year. It's a year is going to come around. So you can either decide that it's valuable enough to spend a little bit of time every day and work on this through the year and that year eventually comes around, or you can just keep putting it off and let those years keep piling up, and then you can look back 5 years and you could go, you know what? Man, if I would have just put a little bit of time in every day 4 years ago, I would have had that thing smoked, and now I'm still kind of halfway doing it.
I like how you have this way of saying 4 years so no one thinks you're talking about me and, you know, slapping me in my... No, anyway.
Did you hear Alexa got in on that one again?
She's
as well.
Like, yes, practice.
I think we should start miking her up for these shows because she just occasionally comes on from time to time.
I think it's going to be funny when, like, expensive xylophones show up at your on your doorstep and stuff. There's some of those stories about television showing up and people's doors, you know, like Amazon Prime, like, hey.
You know my wife. I've got Alexa on lockdown over here.
I'd like a set of new hands to show up at my door. That'd be awesome.
Order from the Jack Bell School of Technique.
Heck yeah. 2-day free shipping at yearly. Oh man. That advice is incredible. And I think it kind of points to two things. One is our impatience and our lack of dedication, which I could speak to with authority. But more importantly, you know, you're looking at a time where so much is about immediate results and so much is about, you know, our lives are like, so based on them because of technology, because of vehicles, because of this and that, you know, like even down to something stupid like on-demand television, you know, you don't have to wait mm-hmm. to see the rerun, or, you know, you don't have to be home at 8 o'clock on Tuesday night to see your show, all that crap. We're so programmed to be like, yeah, this is piece of cake and I want immediate results. But this is just clearly not going to be. That's like saying, hey, is there an app that could let me run a marathon in a week? Like, no, there's not. So I think that we have, if we can encourage people to not be concerned with immediate results, but be concerned with depth and you know, this whole foundation that's going to get you through the multitude of gigs you're going to do, that we're doing a younger generation a lot of favor.
I've wondered time and time again about the plethora of YouTube videos. And let's take, for example, one of our favorite whipping boys. We love to talk about how everybody's got an instructional version of how to play Rosanna,
mm-hmm.
right?
But people are asking for that, man.
People ask me every day, John, how do you play Rosanna?
I can't believe you don't have a video.
Yeah, it's coming. But it makes me wonder sometimes when a student will put, you know, the Rosanna groove in, and you see that the literal 40 versions that come up, if part of the subliminal message to that is, well, okay, it's a really cool hip sounding groove, but so many people are playing it that it must be easy, and I must be able to get it down really quickly.
Mm.
And the subtext that's completely lost in translation is that this dude, even though that he's not Porcaro and he's playing it really well, it might have taken him 4 years to get that down. You just don't know. You don't know.
Oh, he'd probably tell you it took him 30.
Right.
You know, but man, that's great insight. It is. I never thought about it like that, where, you know, see, there's 15 videos like right here in like queue. Like, how difficult can this be?
How difficult can it be? And the answer is it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Interesting perspective. I appreciate that.
Something that happens occasionally as well is I'll have students that'll come in. And this happens quite often with adult students. I have students come in, and let's say they've been playing for a long time. Sometimes they've been playing since they were teenagers, and they're now in their 40s or 50s, right? Sometimes this is even with other professionals as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll come in, and they'll have an armful of method books. And they're taking a half an hour lesson. And they'll be like, I want to work on future sounds, new breed, syncopation, and master studies. And I'm like, wow, man, those are all incredible methods. Those are all fantastic.
You forgot the 2 year part.
Right. And that's, I'm all with you. I think that's absolutely great. But I think you're trying to cram too much in at one time, because I think you just mentioned New Breed. That book is a lifetime study by itself.
No question.
Same thing.
I mean,
like,
I've heard.
You know, syncopation, master study. They're all basic lifetime studies. You can go as deep into those books as you want to go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be really careful that you don't throw too many things in at one time. And rather what I do, I normally have most students, if they're taking a half an hour lesson, at least work on two different methods, but I call them complementary methods. And so what I'll say is, I'll go, look, why don't we do this? Take, for example, let's say you want to work on jazz. Why don't we work out of the Chapin book? That's one of the ones they brought in. And also, why don't we work out of the Wilcox and Swing Solos book, right? Because
yeah,
those two things are going to complement one another. You're going to be able to work on your independence and your straight-ahead groove chops with the Chapin book. Get a little reading in there as well. And then with the Wilcoxon books, you're still going to be able to swing, but you're going to play more complicated stuff on one surface and get your hands together as well, and your reading together on top of that. Another example, man, you could say, let's say they brought in future sounds, right? And then they brought in another snare drum technique book. Well, I say, well, what about this? Why don't we work on Future Sounds, which is the Garibaldi book that deals with like a lot of linear concepts. It's that whole Bay Area linear funk drumming thing, right? But instead of working on this other stuff you're talking about, why don't we work on something complementary, say like Stick Control? Stick Control, especially if you think of those first few pages, it's nothing but hand-to-hand style exercises, mm-hmm. right? And different types of exercises that you can still also break up between the drum set to make linear type patterns. So my whole thing is look, I love the aggressive attitude of like, hey, I need to learn some stuff. And sometimes it's almost like I got to make up for lost time, right? I understand that. But there's another way you can skin that cat. There's a complementary way that you can do it that's going to make a little bit more sense instead of just trying to just throw a whole bunch of stuff up against the wall and see what sticks, because that for sure is a prescription for frustration and ultimately probably quitting.
The other thing about the method thing, when you're talking about, you know, ones of that depth, is you can't put any kind of time frame on that stuff with any individual, because mm-mm.
everybody's different.
Something you might zip through in, you know, one thing I might completely struggle with and try to get, and vice versa. And it's like, that's one thing that I think people need to be way more focused on, is actually accomplishing what this method is trying to show you and teach you and get under your hands, versus, oh, well, I heard so-and-so did it in a year, so I'm going to have it together in a year. It's like, man, no. Mm-mm. Don't do that.
Nope.
Go with the end result being the focus and not a time frame or a, you know, and that goes for not being frustrated about if it's lengthy or two. If this is a valuable information to you and it's going to get you where you want to be, take the time to get it right.
I'll bet you right now we could call either Rosenblatt or Weckl, and because they are both big fans of like the Chester New Breed.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet you we could call both of them right now, and I bet you steak dinner that neither one of them have done everything in those books. That'll tell you a little bit about the depth and just the overall lifetime style of study that those kind of methods really demand from you. So
good stuff. Yeah, that's a pretty good barometer there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John, this last part of this topic that I want to talk about is something that's a little bit touchy, but it's something that you and I, we see it. We see it and we feel it from time to time. And this is not directly related to playing, but it's an important aspect of what we do. And that topic is when you're in social settings, when you're in the proverbial drummer hangs, when you're hanging out with your buddies, when you're hanging out with other musicians, I think it's really important to be aware of yourself, aware of your surroundings, and be real careful about not rushing the process of getting yourself, trying to push yourself into different, we'll call them like musical hierarchies, different kinds of little circles of people that you maybe sometimes, quite frankly, don't need to be in just yet. Mm. You need to work your way in.
Yep.
Because let me tell you, it's real easy, and you and I have seen people absolutely spin these incredible webs of BS, and they really don't have much to back it up. And the underlying theme to this entire thing is, if you do something like that, and then you are fortunate enough to get yourself inside of that scene, this highly coveted scene, and you don't have anything to back it up, and then you get called upon to play, you're probably done.
Whew. That is truth and then some. You know, we are living in a time where BS rules, and your best face forward rules, and your padded resume, for lack of better terms, is at the forefront. And there is there's two things I think that you have to be careful about. One is not rushing in when you're not physically and technically ready to be in circles, you know, high level gigs, what have you, in, you know, all that. But I think the other part of it that can be lost on this is it's a given if you are trying to get your straight ahead playing together and you go in and you play with these guys that are just way over your head, and you know, there's going to be some that are encouraging. There's going to be some like, hey, that guy can't play. Well, that's a drag. Either way, it's like, you know, man, come on. But the one thing that I've learned is a genuine relationship is far more important than their opinion of your ability. Mm-hmm. And I mean, man, I'm friends with some of the baddest cats on the planet. And it had nothing to do with how I play. Nothing. It has to do with just connecting on a personal level. And you can't lose sight of that while you're growing and while you're progressing. Like, hey, you're really getting together. That at the end of the day, no matter how good you are, you know, relationships are going to be the thing that comes into it. And that's a long-winded way of getting to this point. You can't force that either.
Mm-mm.
You know,
it's disingenuous.
And look, man, sometimes you may be gunning to be tight with someone who just isn't real open to relationships of any depth, mm-hmm. or they have their circles and they're perfectly happy with it and they're not really interested in letting anyone else in those circles. Is that fair or not? It doesn't matter. But if you don't have that genuine approach and you don't have that ability to read that situation from individual to individual, you're not, it doesn't matter how far you got in the Chapin book or it how doesn't. Far you got in the Chafee book or how, you know, any of that. So be careful with that as well. Like, you know, you can't rush that any more than you can, you know, you're playing or just getting in certain circles. There's a relationship aspect to it too that you've got to be mindful of.
There's a lot of credence to the general, genuine and organic curve of making relationships with people. They last 10 times longer and are 10 times stronger than, like you said, if you force your way in with a big truckload of BS.
Mm-hmm. Or... Yeah, exactly, man. Or be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I can be friends with amazing straight-ahead jazz players, but I'm not trying to convince them that's what I am.
Mm-hmm.
I have plenty to offer outside of that. And the people that I know that play at any kind of level, be it, you know, world-class on down, it hasn't really had much to do with my playing. So you need to be way more locked into individual relationships and genuine relationships. So that's something that I live and die by that way more than playing. But it factors into what we're talking about today, which is not rushing mm-hmm. these things.
One last thing I want to say about this part of the topic is something that you and I have mentioned on the show before, and I actually listened to a little bit of an interview with someone that contradicted it and said the obvious, but we're going to go into the whole thing again. We're talking about humans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You and I have talked about on the show that it's very important that when people call you for gigs, that you take gigs that you know you can do
mm-hmm.
and that you know you can do a good job on, because just frankly, there are times that it's inappropriate to take certain gigs. If somebody called me up right now and said, man, I need you to you know, come out and play this real heavy vibe gig, am I going to say yes? I don't even own a set of vibes right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the contradictory aspect of this, or the thing that somebody has said something that's a little bit different, is I was watching an interview the other day and had Omar Hakim, and he was doing a little question and answer, and he was talking about how he got himself established in New York, and his whole thing was, man, when somebody called me to play a gig, I never said no, Never said no. Omar Hakim, by the time he was 21 or 22 years old, again, we're talking about somebody that's not a human.
Right. Well, capable of every gig that was offered him.
Yeah. Because, I mean, one of his first major gigs was Weather Report. I mean, you know, does that not encapsulate the entire point right there?
It pretty much sums it up. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he took over after Peter Erskine, and just no disrespect to that band before that, because that band before that was with Jocko and Peter Erskine. But I think it's fairly well known that Zawinul said he thought the strongest, best group that he ever had together was with that group that had Omar Hakim and Victor Bailey. Now, think about that for a minute.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of Eastern European button pushing and ego and him still being bitter from Jocko stealing the show many a night.
Yeah,
but that's just a dumb groove pig's opinion. What do I know?
All right, well, let's finish off today. We'll talk.
Notice there's no response or argument from you.
Are you saying there's some Austrian hate being thrown around?
Well, look, if you have Jocko in your band for a number of years and you never compliment him,
yeah,
you might have some other issues going on. I don't know. Maybe. Just a little?
Not
taking anything away from the amazing musician and composer he is, but you probably have some issues.
Couple of pretty good drummers prefaced Omar as Alex Acuna and Peter Erskine. Pretty good. So, pretty good Mount Rushmore Hall of Fame drummers there. So
yeah, Heavy Weather would, you know, if you're saying there's periods of time where it was any better than that, you're just not being very realistic. Because I kind of look at Weather Report as an exception to the rule. It's almost like from beginning to end, you know, if you're like, you can maybe have a preference, but to go like, oh, it's just night and day better.
Yeah.
You're drunk.
You know what? Maybe I'll step back and say that let's go with this. We'll say Zawinul said that was his preference.
That's
how about
cool.
that? We'll
That's
go. Cool. Maybe not say better.
We'll now you're taking all the fun out of the assessment. There was European hate.
The guy's
ego.
Dead. He can't even come back, man, and come back to us and clarify.
Right. But I'm so. Right. I know I'm right.
So here we have our segment of the quarter, as it's turning out to be again. And we're going to do an underrated drum track. And we got a couple of jewels for you today. John, why don't you go first with yours?
Mine is often overlooked by a drummer that we like to wax poetic about. The drummer is Jim Keltner, who I've spoke of in the past, even in this segment, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're correct.
But the track, and I heard it about a couple weeks ago and was reminded of nothing more than how amazing it feels, is the song Dreamweaver by Gary Wright. Hit in the 70s, a big hit, really well. But man, you know, for all Keltner's quirky, bizarre, rootsy vocabulary, this one just kind of, he's just laying it down silky smooth, and it just elevates into some magic on the choruses. But just a straight up reminder of what Keltner can do, which is just play silky smooth beautiful grooves. And I say underrated, and there's some people that are going to be like, oh, I love that, of course. Well, of course you do, but my point is we tend to focus on quite a few other things he's done and forget how amazing that track is.
See, you got me on that one, man. I didn't realize that was Keltner on there.
There you go.
I mean, this is you used this segment to its utmost potential. So, congratulations.
Quite welcome.
Mine has a little bit of the same bones as yours. And my track comes from a guy that I think we've talked about on the show, but I don't know. Have we ever done an underrated drummer or an underrated track with this guy?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. But, I mean, he's a legendary guy. And, boy, he He played on quite a few incredible tracks back in the 70s and 80s, and my guy is Rick Murata. And the track that I'm going to talk about is one that probably a lot of people are not aware that he played on. It's a Jackson Browne tune from the late 70s called Boulevard. And just to kind of highlight the fact that it's a little bit odd that he's on this, is that he on the album that this track came from, this is the only track that Rick Murata plays on. Russ Kunkel plays on the rest of them. And the thing that I want everybody to get out of or get from this track when you listen to it is that this is a really gritty, hanging it out rock and roll tune, which first off is a little bit different for Jackson Browne because, you know, we always think of him as being very, you know, Los Angeles, super glossy, ultra produced, very slick kind of songwriting and production. This borrows more from a kind of a Bob Seger-esque, straight up rock and roll tune, right? And also when you hear the drums, it sounds like Murata's playing on, if not fiberglass drums, definitely concert toms. It's got that real traditional 70s kind of a splatty, throaty kind of a sounding tom, which starts off with a great tom fill. And then the other thing I want everybody to notice about the groove is that if you'll check it out, Murata's playing a lot of eighth notes on the snare, a la Bonham on like the tune Rock and Roll, you know, that we hear. It's almost like he's playing a straight eighth version of a shuffle, so to speak, you know, where he's playing maybe like the note before the backbeat, you know, on the snare drum, ghosting it, kind of leads into that.
Yep.
And it's just a really cool, really hip kind of a sound that anybody could have just played this tune with just a 2-4 backbeat. But Murata kind of heard something a little bit different in there, and it kind of lends to that gritty, hanging it out kind of a rock and roll vibe that he's playing. And so that's my pick. Murata on Jackson Browne, Boulevard.
Man.
1979, somewhere in there.
I love that guy. That's some great. That's a great call. And I think a lot of people wouldn't know he's on that as well.
Yeah.
So two that certain people that should know might not.
Yeah.
And that is a great example of underrated in itself.
Do yourself a favor and go and listen to both of these tracks. And as usual, I will put them in the show notes for this as well. Which leads me to say, John,
before I forget,
yes?
One thing that's interesting about Dreamweaver, it's just Gary and Jim Keltner. Gary does all the keyboards.
Everything else, huh?
He does everything. Jim's the only one outside of Gary playing.
Wow.
Which is kind of cool.
That's very cool.
I mean, maybe sort of cool, but whatever.
If you want to throw a little weirdness about this track that I talked about, Boulevard, you'll hear maracas on the end of it. That's actually Danny Korchmar playing maracas.
good on you, producer man.
I was going to say, yeah, like he needs another credit, right?
Yeah. I wonder if he got paid double.
Of course he did. Why would you put those on there if he didn't get, like, he's probably got like a union double on that.
I got to produce records.
No kidding, but we missed the time that you could make money by about 25 years, so never mind.
Nah.
All right, guys, thanks for tuning in. As always, we love it when you guys stay in touch with us. Head on over to our website. We are at www.drummersweeklygroovecast.com. That's drummersweeklygroovecast.com. Everything Drummers Weekly Groovecast is aggregated at that site. You can find all of our episodes there. You can find all of our videos there. You can communicate with us through our contact form. You can manage your subscriptions there because you can find us there at iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, Stitcher, all that good stuff. And you can also find us on social media. We have the requisite Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook pages. I think that's it, John. I've gotten it. I've got that little ending spiel knocked down a good bit since we've got the website going. It's all in one place.
Nice.
Glad you approve.
I'm distracted, sorry.
You got something to do. I know you do.
I gotta go.
All right, guys. Until next Monday, we'll see you later. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.